is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, we have a lot on our plate today, and I'll be getting back to your calls in a little bit. But right now, Professor Richard Wolff is with us, the economist, the co-founder of democracyatwork.info, the author of numerous books. His most recent, The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself, also now available as an ebook. The websites rdwolf with two Fs.com and democracyatwork.info. You can tweet him at Prof Wolf, as in Professor Wolf, Profwolff. And Professor Wolf, welcome back to the program. This Chinese property group, Evergrande, was blamed for yesterday's stock market blip, along with the news that the Republicans are going to refuse to try to raise the debt ceiling. This is all over the international financial news. It's all over the Financial Times. And I'm guessing most Americans have no idea what's going on, what this company is, why a company in China might move international markets, what they're up to, and what it might portend for the future. Can you fill us in?
Sure. Evergrande is one of the biggest companies in China. It is a real estate developer. At least that's what we would call it in this country. They build housing blocks. They build whole communities. Like real estate dealers everywhere in the world, they're highly leveraged. What that means is they borrow huge amounts of money, and they do that from syndicates of banks. So what you have is a large number of banks, both Chinese and non-Chinese, that is, banks in London and New York and Paris and so on, providing the various portions of the money lent to this builder to go ahead and build apartments. And what happened was, when you have the kind of debts it does, which are in the hundreds of billions of dollars, because China is a huge country and they are building like there's no tomorrow, as they have been for decades, we're talking about an enormous amount of money, and they have to pay interest on that enormous amount of money, and they have to pay back portions of the principal. And there was a payment due, if I understand the details, yesterday. Some of the debt they owe is to Chinese lenders. That's called domestic debt. And the other one is owed to foreigners, U.S. and other bankers, insurance companies, and whoever lends to them. There were rumors that they would not be able to make the money needed to pay off their domestic debts, which were due yesterday. Up until the last minute, these rumors swirled. The company did not deny it. The Chinese government in Beijing was mum about it. And so the rumors swirled, because the whole world knows that much of the development in China is fueled by borrowing, and that therefore there's always a risk that the borrowers have overestimated what they can do and will find themselves in a pickle and unable to cover their debt. So there's lots of speculation, been going on for decades, that the Chinese will at this moment or that moment fail, that they will be unable to pay back their debts. That will plunge their banks into all kinds of difficulty. That will plunge foreigners. And so what you saw in the build-up to yesterday was anxiety in stock markets around the world, including here in New York, when people guesstimated whether or not they would fail to meet the payment and what the ripple effects of that would be. As has happened over and over again in the last 25 years, the rumors proved to be, I'll be polite here, wildly excessive. They made the domestic part of their payments yesterday. We don't know many details, but the payment was announced by both the company in question, Evergrande, and by some of its domestic lenders. And now the next question is, can they meet the foreign debt payment? It's due, I think, in a week or so. And again, you'll see some swirling rumors. But my advice, if that's where you're going with your question, Tom, is not to get excited about this. The Chinese are now so important a player that if one of their companies looks like it might not pay its debts, it's global financial news. Nothing announces the importance of the People's Republic of China onto the world scene like this one does. And number two, the Chinese government, acutely aware that it is now the number two economic powerhouse in the world, number two to the United States, and catching up with each passing week, no way are they going to permit anything to disrupt their arrival on the world scene as the ascending global economic power, which they clearly are. So you put all this together, and my guess is this is a tempest in a teapot. It will make a lot of noise, but mostly what you're seeing is the kind of up and down in the markets that we should have become familiar with in the West. China joining the West in terms of its economic importance has these kinds of bumps along the way. If anything, their government is in more active involvement in the economy than here, and so they will find ways, both public and private, both publicly announced and privately arranged, to get through this crisis, thereby impressing the whole world with how well they have their newfound power under control.
Which raises the question, how did a theoretically communist country end up with a nearly laissez-faire capitalist economy?
Well, they don't really have that, Tom. They have a mixture. If ever the term mixed economy was applicable, it is to China. Let me explain. If you take one kind of quote-unquote socialism, the Scandinavian or the Western European, what you have is private enterprise owned and operated by private individual capitalists or shareholders in the corporate form, with the government coming in with lots of controls and regulations. They call that socialism or democratic socialism or socialist democracy. At the other end of the range of these mixed economies, you have the Soviet Union. There, the government took over the ownership and operation, at least in industry, leaving the private sector quite small and limited to agricultural individual plots. What China did is start out being rather like the Soviet Union, and then when Mao passed, shifting over to occupy a place you might say is midway between the Soviet model, where the government owns and operates, and the Scandinavian model, where the government merely intervenes and regulates, but leaves the ownership and operation in private hands. What China is literally a mixture of those two. All of that under the regulatory control of the state and the Communist Party of China. What the Chinese claim, and by the way, they call this socialism with Chinese characteristics, which is another way of saying it isn't the Scandinavian and it isn't the Soviet. What they believe is they found the model of a society that can, in a way, get the best of both of these arrangements by carefully dividing the economy, giving private enterprise the places where it excels, giving government-owned and operate the sectors where that excels, and keeping the whole thing under the control of a central authority so that when they have something that's really national in scope, they can mobilize both private and public resources to meet the challenge. And let me tell you, the world is taking a lot of notice because of COVID. I mean, let's get clear. The Chinese have had 6,000 deaths from COVID. That's 1% of the deaths from COVID in the United States, and China has four times the population of our country. This is an achievement that may not be a big news item in the United States, but I can assure you, and I read a lot of foreign newspapers, it is number one piece of news as the whole world tries to understand why was it possible for this poor country, which China was and in many ways still is, how is it possible for them to organize a system able to demonstrate that kind of prowess?
And what role does authoritarianism play in this? I mean, shouldn't it be unnecessary for them to crack down on Hong Kong's democracy movement, for example, and play all these authoritarian? Is that just about keeping the corrupt rulers in power, or is that absolutely necessary for this economic system?
My guess, it's a mixture of both. In other words, on the one hand, they have hit upon a system. I mean, let me give you a couple more statistics. For the last 25 years, their annual GDP growth has been between 6% and 9%. Over the same 25 years, the annual GDP growth here in the United States has been between 2% and 3%. They're growing at three times the rate of the United States. Over the same period of time, the real wages of the average worker in China has quadrupled, whereas the real wage in the United States has stagnated. Hasn't gone down, but hasn't gone up either. I mean, these are achievements that make China the envy of literally every other country in the world, and certainly every country in Asia, Africa, Latin America, and so on. And so they looking at a model that is working for them beyond what I suspect any of them foresaw as possible. But will you have, if you give the government the regulation power that it has, will you have examples of overstepping that power, using it where it isn't necessary, where it is even politically counterproductive? I think you have those examples. I don't know enough about Hong Kong or the Uyghurs and so on to be sure that that's what's going on, but it wouldn't surprise me. I think one of the great critiques of 20th century socialism has been the power of the government, and I know that that's being debated inside China for sure as we speak.
Fascinating stuff. I always learn something. Thank you so much, Professor Richard Wolff. Great talking to you.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
And be sure to check out his new book, The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. It's also now available as an e-book. We will be right back, 18 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Pick up your phone calls, actually, right after the break. Stick around. And welcome back. Jim in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Jim, thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today?
How you doing, Tom? Actually, I'm watching on YouTube. Yeah.
Oh, okay. It's all good.
Very, very much so. I watch you every day of the week, so you're my mentor and you are my savior for information. Thank you for Richard Wolff. He's the greatest.
It's one smart guy.
Tom, I just want to say you scared me earlier, and I've been hearing about it for the last few days, Tom, about why we're having a problem in Congress about raising the debt ceiling.
Right.
Tom, I mean, my goodness, didn't they do that to Obama?
They did.
A couple times?
They did.
Shut down the government?
Yeah, and in fact, they shut down the government, and it caused the United States bond debt ratings to go down, which increased our interest rates right across the board, which made houses more expensive, it made cars, anything you buy on credit more expensive, increased inflation in the United States. It damaged our economy. And the Republicans did it just because they wanted to damage Barack Obama. They did it just in advance of the 2012 election.
So they're pulling it again on Joe Biden. So, Tom, we do have a slim margin. Is there any Democrat that would not want to agree to raise the debt ceiling? I mean, I don't understand, Tom. I'm on Social Security disability. I'm 62 years old. I worked for 30-some years and got sick. And can't work anymore. You mean to tell me they're going to kick out seniors out of their homes because we can't get goddamn Social Security? You know, we pay rent, you know, we pay utilities, we pay for food, we do all this. What are they going to do? Put everybody out on the streets because they don't want to raise the debt ceiling?
We'll see. I don't think that it's ever been done through reconciliation, Jim, and that's what the Democrats are trying to do right now. They're trying to pass an appropriations bill that'll keep the government going until the end of the year and raise the debt ceiling and at the same time, and they're going to try and pass it with reconciliation, which is going to require all 50 senators and, of course, the majority in the House. And, you know, we'll see. It is high-stakes gambling is what's going on.
Well, Tom, I think that's more of a pertinent thing than even the bill that the Reconstruction bill. I mean, my goodness, you're going to have people on the streets.
Yeah, yeah. No, it this has the potential to do mind-numbing damage to the United States. And if they stretch it out, you know, the Republicans weren't willing to do this when they went after Bill Clinton when Newt Gingrich shut down Congress in 1996 over the debt ceiling. When they did it to Barack Obama in 2011 and shut down government, they weren't willing to take it so far as, I mean, they softened the economy, they created political damage for the Democratic president, but they weren't willing to take it so far that the United States actually defaulted on its debts, on treasury bonds and treasury bills. Yeah. If they do that this time, we are screwed in unimaginable ways.
Oh, my goodness. I just can't believe what's going on.
It would create a worldwide crash. I mean, it literally would be, you know, the right now the U.S. is, you know, the dollar is the kind of the last currency, you know, out there. And probably the world would look at us and say, okay, enough of that. We're going to go to the euro. Or, you know, China wants the renminbi, the Chinese yuan, to be the world currency. I think the euro is more likely, but they would dump dollars, and that would screw us, too. Jim, thanks for the call. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Paul in Elmhurst, Illinois. Hey, Paul, thanks for calling. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I'm just thinking, is the likes of Jim Jordan and Boebert and Green and Holly, do you think they're so far down the rabbit hole they just can't get out of it, so they have to go forward with all the garbage that they're pulling?
I think what happened, Paul, is that there was this window of opportunity, and it lasted probably the 4 years of the Trump administration and maybe an additional 6 months of the tail end of 2016 before the election, where if you, as a Republican politician, adopted Trumpy positions, and there's a whole spectrum of them, but they're basically right-wing populist, kind of neo-fascist populist positions. If you adopted those positions, you would win Republican primaries and you could win general elections against Democrats. And I think that what has changed in the last 6 months, particularly, and I think this is as much of a change as we saw in the last 6 months of 2016. I think what has changed is that those Trumpy positions that are held by people like Marjorie Taylor Greene or Lauren Boebert or Matt Gaetz, Jim Jordan, I think that those Trumpy positions will still win you a Republican primary. And this, in a way, is kind of good news for Democrats. But I don't think they'll win you a general election outside of some of the most extreme, all-white, very reactionary rural areas in America. And so I think that these people's day has passed. And I may be wrong. Time will tell. In fact, the next election is going to tell us. But that's what I think is happening, Paul. Did I answer your question?
Well, and let me give you a little tidbit here that I got. My niece is an emergency room doctor in Belfast in the north of Ireland. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to her yesterday, and she says that they're afraid now of hospitals closing down in the winter because of COVID. Could be so bad in Europe come the winter.
Yeah. And this is because you've got foreign trolls who are also promoting vaccine skepticism across Europe as well as in North America.
We're in a world of hurt, Tom. That's all I can say.
Yeah, it's a tough one, Paul.
Thanks.
It's a real tough one. Paul, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, and on top of COVID, you know, you've got flu season coming too, which also, you know, puts people in the hospital. It's a tough time. It's a tough time. But we will get through this, right? Here we are, the Tom Hartman Program, the place where despair is not an option. And it's really not. We will get through this. And what's the old saying? What doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
I think in many ways we actually are stronger now than we were before COVID. And certainly COVID helped us get rid of Donald Trump. Small blessing, right? And welcome back, Tom Hartman with you. I just wanted to give you kind of a moment of geek, a moment of memory, as it were. This is President Dwight Eisenhower.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is two electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is two fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement. We pay for a single fighter plane with 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron.
That's Dwight Eisenhower's famous cross of iron speech. It was given while he was president of the United States. And boy, would I like to hear something like that again. I think we're on the edge of it. And this guy was a Republican, right? He was the last legitimately elected Republican president who didn't commit treason or follow one who committed treason to become president. Dwight Eisenhower. Amazing. Anyhow, let's pick up your phone calls here. Grant in Ventura, California. Hey, Grant, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I just want to connect a few more dots and add to Senator Whitehouse's information on justice or injustice Kavanaugh.
Sure.
All Trump's appointments, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett, have something in common. They all served on G.W. Bush's legal team that argued before the Supreme Court to stop the recount in Florida and give Bush the 2000 election.
Now, I knew that Kavanaugh had. I didn't know that Gorsuch and Amy Coney Barrett had served on that team.
Yes, they had served on that team.
And John Roberts was one of the lead guys on that team.
Yeah.
Which is why Bush put him in the Supreme Court. That's amazing.
Exactly.
So these are all people who have helped steal an election.
Exactly. And it should be noted, Tom, that Roger Stone initiated the stopping of the recount in Florida, sending white men by bus with baseball bats to stop the Wade County recount process.
Yeah, I remember
that. And Stone would later bring violent insurrection by bus from Georgia to try and block Biden's certification.
Yeah.
So Stone is tied to both the Koch brothers and to George Bush.
And Richard Nixon.
To say that George Bush is the sanity of the Republican Party is like saying Goebbels is the sanity of the Nazi Party.
Right.
And I learned this information from reading Dark Money, which is a fantastic book by Jane Mayer.
Yeah. Remarkable stuff. I guess it just kind of stands alone. Grant, thank you very much for the call. And, you know, here we are, right? We've got to do something. Howard in New York City. Hey, Howard, what's up?
Yeah, hi. I get so tired of the Democrats describing problems well, but not really fixing them. So I had an idea, and tell me if I'm crazy, that you can pretty much single-handedly force Manchin to give up the filibuster and vote for H.R. 1. And here's what I'm thinking. We had discussed last week about North Korea being so afraid of the spies and the jailings, then Abbott in Texas, and you said, yeah, but it's not only them, it's also Hitler in 1933 and Mussolini in the 20s. My idea would be for you to invite the Lincoln Project, I don't care what Rick Wilson or Steve Schmidt, tell them that the problem now is that Manchin, by not voting for H.R. 1, will single-handedly be allowing Trump to become president and bestowing on Trump all of the Abbott things, the Mussolini powers, the Hitler powers, put it all over West Virginia and embarrass the hell out of them.
I think they already know this, Howard. I mean, Steve Schmidt has been ranting about this at some length, as has Rick Wilson, although Steve Schmidt, I think, is more high profile, for some time.
And it's having no effect.
No, not to the best of my knowledge. And I believe that they have run ads against the filibuster. I may be wrong about that. Whether they've run ads against the filibuster, but you know, and it's tough making common cause with Republicans, but you know they're onto this. I mean, they're absolutely right. So, anyhow, Howard, thank you. It's an idea, but I don't think it's going to work. Keep thinking though. You got some good ones, Howard. Norm in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Norm, how's Florida?
No, it's not Fort Lauderdale. It's Louisville.
It's Louisville, Florida?
Greenville.
I'm sorry, say it again. You need to get your mouth closer to your microphone, Norm.
Greenville.
Greenville. Okay, got it. So what's up?
I want to know why it's taking so long to put Trump in jail.
That's a good question. Prosecutors have an appropriate tendency to want to cross all the T's and dot all the I's, get all the evidence, collect all the data. It's looking increasingly like people in the Trump organization, which I think could probably be accurately described as an organized crime operation, are going to go down. The question is, will any of them rat out Trump? Because he runs that business like a mob boss. He puts nothing in writing. He doesn't give explicit directives. He implies things. Michael Cohen has talked about this at length. And I think they're also terrified, people like Alan Weisselberg, I think they're terrified of testifying against Trump, not just because they're afraid of vengeance from Donald Trump, but because Donald Trump is tied into multiple criminal networks that employ assassination. You know, both the Russian oligarch network, there are other foreign oligarch networks that Trump is part of, and just the good old-fashioned Italian mafia in New York City that Trump has been in deep with since the 60s. So, you know, I think it's really, really tough to go. I mean, they're basically going after a mob boss and who also had the power of being president of the United States for a while. So I think it's going to be a real challenge for them, but I am not despairing that nothing can be done. And I think the fact that Trump has been squealing so loudly this week after they just discovered 3 million new tax documents in one of their witnesses' basements is some indication of that. Norm, thanks for the call. John in Queens, New York. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, how you doing, Tom? Listen, I have an idea that this whole thing about the debt ceiling mm-hmm. is a bluff on the part of the Republicans. I mean, I don't know exactly. I wish I could have called before Professor Wolf was on, but it seems to me that a move like that would destroy the fortunes of, you know, the people who actually own the Republicans, the Kochs, the Mercers, the DeVoses, as well as the major corporations. I mean, how would that affect J.P. Morgan? How would that affect Goldman Sachs? I'm thinking it's a bluff, and they won't be permitted to pull. And Romney, I mean, Romney's a multimillionaire, almost a billionaire. How would that affect his money?
Well, there's a foundational assumption at the base of your question, John, that is a dangerous and incorrect assumption, respectfully.
Okay.
And that is that when the economy crashes, it hurts everybody. That's not true. If you know that the economy is going to crash, a crash in the economy can be your best friend. When Joseph Kennedy, John Kennedy's father, in the 1920s, he famously told this story. In fact, Gloria Swanson, who used to be a friend of mine before she died, in her autobiography, she talks about this. Joe Kennedy, when a shoeshine boy offered him a stock tip, he thought, okay, this is it. It's time to get out of the market. He got out of the market. He had a pile of cash. The market crashed, and after the market crashed, he went back in and he bought like there was no tomorrow, and he ended up one of the richest men in America as a consequence of that, as did J.P. Morgan. So if you know how to bet against the market, and these guys know how to do it, it's called selling short, or if you know how to just get liquid, you know, just convert everything into cash, and there's been like $1 trillion pulled out of the market in the last year of people moving it into essentially cash instruments. I think these people
are talking
about
$15 trillion. I mean, a $15 trillion impact. I think that would be just hard to avoid for everybody.
I think that's true. But for the mind-bogglingly rich billionaires who control the Republican Party, I think they're insulated from it. John, I got to run.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I don't think that the Republicans are playing chicken here. Now, the Democrats are going to have to rescue the Republic all by themselves, and they're going to get no credit for it. And welcome back, Michael in Chicago. Hey, Michael, thanks for watching us on YouTube. What's up?
Hey, I just finished your book on the hidden history of American oligarchy, and I'm doing, as a hobby, but also to write a book, I'm revamping the United States Constitution to be more of a democracy and get all the best ideas from the left wing. But I am stuck on the implementation of the reinstating the Fairness Doctrine and the telecommunication laws that require local ownership of media. How would those affect your show, The Young Turks, The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman? Like, how would it interact with that?
Well, first of all, I'm guessing that you're operating under a misunderstanding of what the Fairness Doctrine required. It did not require that radio or television stations have politically balanced programming. All it required was that if the ownership of a station, and this was a common thing back in the day, back when I worked at WGIM-TV when I was 17 years old, back in 1966, the station, or 68 I guess it was, the owner of the station would come on and give an editorial in the evening, you know, a little 60-second editorial. And we had to balance that. In fact, it was part of my job to help find the guy, you know, some local guy who would say the opposing voice, right? But if it wasn't the owner of the station, there was no requirement for balance. That was the only requirement for balance. And then the other part of the Fairness Doctrine required that stations do what was called, quote, programming in the public interest. And mostly what that meant was run public service announcements and, you know, just don't get too crazy. So the Fairness Doctrine would have no effect on me or my radio stations whatsoever. The Telecommunications Act allowed for massive consolidation of stations and allowed for multi-state ownership of radio and television stations, and led to three companies controlling probably 80% of all the radio stations in the United States. And one television network, Sinclair, owning over 200 television stations. If the original ownership rules were put into place, forcing a breakup of those so that they went back to local ownership, I think the principal effect that it would have on my show and on other progressive shows is that we would suddenly have hundreds of stations who might be interested in carrying our shows, rather than just taking the right-wing stuff that it's being crammed down from, you know, the billionaire ownership and management of these big networks. Answer your question, Michael?
I think so. So it wouldn't, like, if they were implemented as a law or a constitutional article, it wouldn't be like, oh, TYT is just abolished now by law.
No. And by the way, these are not constitutional issues. I mean, arguably they are, because they fall under the Commerce Clause. But, you know, the FCC, the FCC regulation, the ownership laws, all that kind of stuff, those are simply laws. And the Supreme Court has determined over the years on multiple occasions that they were entirely constitutional laws, because the federal government does have the power to regulate interstate commerce in the United States, which is what most of this falls under.
Okay. All right, cool. Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome. Michael, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It's 49 minutes past the hour, coming up on 10 minutes before the hour, and I will be back with you taking your calls in just 60 seconds. Please hang on. We'll be right back. Stick around. And welcome back. Picking up your phone calls, Luigi in Pensacola, Florida. Hey, Luigi, what's on your mind today?
Good afternoon, Tom, and thank you, Professor. Let's see, should I take a Hartman economics class today or a Hartman political science class? I'm dumbfounded. But anyway, there was a gentleman earlier that called about, the education, supposed post-secondary education bill in Florida, and I have the copy of it here. Essentially, and I know you've spoken about it before, essentially what it does, it required the Florida State College system to annually assess the intellectual freedom and viewpoint diversity. And also, it shielded faculty members or, say, staff members of SEA or anyone who is afraid of any ideas or opinions that they might find uncomfortable. That's basically part of what the bill does, okay? And, of course, it's being challenged right now. But old Warney, our governor, DeSantis, he bragged about it last week when some of the lower courts overturning his mask mandates and other mandates, mm-hmm. but he doesn't care about that because it's going on to the circuit courts and other courts that he appointed all the judges, and he bragged about it, and sure enough, they upheld his point of view in the court. So, I mean, I'm sorry to go on, Tom, because what you had today was an incredible array. So, Mr. Professor, I'll let you... I just can't. I love talking to you.
Yeah, well, thank you, Luigi. And you're absolutely right. And this is one of, you know, similar laws that are being introduced all across the United States to basically prevent teachers from teaching anything that might, quote, make people uncomfortable. And what that is code for is teaching the history of race in the United States. And the people that it would make uncomfortable are the white supremacists who think that only white people should be running this country, only white people should be making decisions in this country, and only white people should be on the media. You know, it's like, it's just, I mean, they just want to take America back to the 1950s, because we really were there for a long, long time. And it's very unfortunate. Thanks a lot for the call, Luigi. It's a good one. Thank you for adding to the contributing to the conversation. Matt in Spartanburg, South Carolina. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind today?
Not much, Tom. How you doing today?
I'm fine. What's up?
I was calling to talk about China. China with their COVID deaths. I think that they're severely undernumbered, if I might say.
I'm guessing you're right, particularly in the regions that where the Uyghurs live. But you know, who knows? They're claiming that they've got about 6,000 COVID deaths. We have 660,000.
Yeah, South Carolina has 12. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Yeah, on the one hand. On the other hand, they're vaccinating like crazy. They shut down the whole country. You know, they have extraordinary police powers. So, you know, it's possible.
Yeah, but why would they want to, I mean, essentially lie?
Because they don't want to look bad in the eyes of the world.
I guess that does make sense.
Yeah, I'm guessing that the 6,000 figure is probably a real figure for most of, you know, metropolitan areas in China. But if you go into the, you know, into the areas near Tibet and, you know, the far western part of China, and particularly the area, I forget what it's called. It starts with an S, but I can't. Anyhow, the area where the Uyghurs live, I'm guessing that there's been an explosion that hasn't been dealt with, and they're just, you know, allowing that to be maybe even population control. Who knows? Because, you know, getting honest information out of China is very difficult. But they did do a good job of cracking down. I mean, you know, Taiwan, which is not a communist state. Taiwan is a progressive democracy. It's much smaller. They only have 23 million people. But Taiwan shut down their country as, you know, they got their first COVID case a day after we got ours. Ours was January 20th, 2020. Theirs was January 21st. And they use their national health program. They have a single-payer health care system in Taiwan. which is very similar to, in some ways, to what China has now put into place. They use that as for testing and contact tracing. And for the entirety of 2020, they had fewer than 20 people die of COVID and just a few thousand cases in the whole country for a whole year. And, you know, now they're up to 16,000 cases and about 800 deaths in Taiwan. Most of that has been from the Delta variant, but they're vaccinating like crazy. So they're, you know, they're getting past that. So it's not like it's impossible. You know, if you have an aggressive program, if you, you know, aggressively shut down the country and take it seriously. Matt, I got to run, but thanks for the call. And thanks for listening to us on SiriusXM. And thanks so much for being with us today. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It does require all of us, all the time, every day. Get out there, get active, participate. The number for Congress, 202-224-3121. Give them a piece of your mind, right? One thing, just pick one topic to talk about and give your two senators and your member of the House a shout. Tag your it. Have a great afternoon. Be good to yourself and the people around you. Thank you.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.